Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
Now, see, this is what you get for listening to a show hosted by two atheists. I mean, you know, you're probably stuck in a car with a family driving around for the holidays and it's excruciating. Or, you know, it's past 1 p.m. on Christmas. You're not fucking doing anything because who does anything, you know, after they like sit around the tree and open crap? Except maybe go see the spirit tonight. Or, you know, you're secular. You're an atheist. You don't celebrate Christmas. And you got nothing to do today, and you open up your iTunes expecting to see your usual end-of-the-week shows. And people aren't giving you stuff because it's the holidays. But this is fucking double feature. This is the show that does not take a goddamn break for Jesus. So we're here. What do you got for me?
Double to nothing on Flutz.
I am Eric, and you, the one who's going to lose the 10-50 Heath Ledger bet. Do you want to explain the bet? Because we've never talked about
this
on
the show. We'll just throw it up. Just see if anybody wants to get in on it.
Please.
We can turn this into kind of like a track bet if we want.
Yeah, maybe.
Can we do
the films first in case people want to know what we're talking about today?
Yeah, okay.
Before we go into this exciting bet.
All right. So the films that we did today were North Fork, which was my film, and Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog.
Man, you got that. Hyphen and all.
Nailed it. But also, more importantly than the films
much
today,
more importantly
are the fact
is how you're going to owe me $10.50.
More importantly is the fact that I have a standing bet with you that Heath Ledger is not dead.
Yeah, what?
And
still?
Double to nothing if he comes out of the ground due to a flood.
Due to a flood.
What? Which brings us to the film.
Wait, you are right. So you do win in both cases on that. How long is it? The Dark Knight came out, 10 years ago?
Yeah, more or
so,
less.
So when do I get my $10.50 is what I'm...
Whenever I have my
you
wallet
You bet me
out.
A ticket to the Dark Knight that Heath Ledger would appear before or during the premiere of the Dark Knight, which we saw.
Uh-huh. He was there.
No, he is dead. You owe me $10.50. Speaking of the Dark Knight, so I saw the prequel to Batman Begins, which is called The Untouchables.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you've seen this.
I have not seen
this,
it.
Right?
You know I haven't seen it.
It's one of those kind of like Godfather-y casino movies.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of that stuff. I've seen like Goodfellas and
not
all that.
Not a big fan of like crime drama.
Yeah, it's not really my thing, but The Untouchables, like set in Chicago, Prohibition, Al Capone, bunch of crooked cops, Sean Connery.
Oh.
It's pretty much Batman Begins. It's pretty much The Dark Knight with like overtones of Batman Begins. I believe some of the dialogue is probably even lifted directly from The Untouchables. It was really kind of strange.
That's weird. I rewatched Pink Flamingos a couple nights ago.
The John Waters film.
The John Waters film.
the definitive John Waters film.
Definitely a more entertaining film when you know it's John Waters. First time I saw it, I didn't know who John Waters was.
Right.
And I'm like, that guy has red hair and now that guy's asshole is singing and now she's eating dog shit.
I will give you your $10.50 back if you can make your younger sister watch Pink Flamingos.
Okay.
So the first movie.
Well, before we talk about the movies, we should mention that we're going to spoil them to death.
So we have chapter markers in the thing. So if you listen to this in iTunes...
Or QuickTime.
I encourage people to like subscribe to this in iTunes because we have no idea how many people listen to this show.
Yeah.
Unless they subscribe in iTunes. So they should do that.
Even so, would we know if there were 90-year-old listeners?
We would if they use iTunes.
Okay. We'll keep that
My
in
point
mind.
Is if you use iTunes, you get chapters and then you can just skip to the next movie. Yeah. Or you could skip through the whole podcast, which is probably the best thing to do.
And then avoid spoilers altogether.
So we're going to spoil North Fork and then Dr.
Horrible's.
Oh, so
the thing about North Fork is that everybody's dead from the very beginning.
North Fork is, where do I know all these people from? Because I know all of them.
They're all like bit parts and I can't really tell you where they all come from. I know James Woods. I mean, that's James Woods.
Well, so James Woods' most important role was the Clerks cartoon. But second most important role,
I would
say... I
didn't see that, nor will I acknowledge that it exists.
But you will acknowledge the existence of Videodrome, right?
Yes, for sure. Well, come on, dude.
All right.
I'm a horror guy.
That is like the James Woods, right?
Yeah.
Am I wrong? All right. Because the whole time I'm trying to pin it, and then I'm like, there's not enough rubber covering him. And then I was like, oh, a Videodrome.
Yeah.
But we also get a little Nick Nolte in this.
There's Nick Nolte.
How do you feel about Nick Nolte?
I want to dislike Nick Nolte just because there's a lot of like flack and shit around him.
Uh-huh.
But I don't really know any what it actually is. I know he like drinks, but like so does Chicago. I've seen him, I think, maybe probably in more, but from off the top of my head, two roles, one being North Fork and the other, his short in the short he's in Parisia Tem.
I've seen him in that and in Ang Lee's The Hulk.
Mm.
Here's where I come down on Nick Nolte. I have this illusion that he's a really good actor because he looks very weathered.
Yeah.
He looks like he's on his deathbed, like he's seen a lot in his life.
A lot like, are you familiar with Kris Kristofferson?
No.
Okay. Did you see Fast Food Nation?
Yes.
Like ranch hand?
Yeah.
Or the like the rancher?
Yeah.
That guy? Like,
yeah, you're kind of just like, oh, he looks really tired.
Yeah.
He got up at 4 a.m. to like tend
he's
to the animals.
He's a method actor.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So
really,
I think
they're just old.
What I'm
they're
getting at is I think Nick Nolte is
they're
cheating.
Just sexist, racist men.
Why do you got to beat on the senior citizens week after week?
They don't listen.
The Senior Citizen Coalition for Double Feature is going to have no members by the end of this episode. Also, Daryl Hannah is in this and she has two eyes. That's all that I can really say about her performance.
And Ben Foster makes a silent role.
Ben Foster's, he's wasted in this film.
Yeah.
I
don't know. I think his role's really good. I'm glad it was him, but I mean, he doesn't speak.
I don't want to say he's wasted just because he doesn't speak, but maybe that's part of it.
By wasted, you don't mean like on a lot of drugs, right?
Well, that's why I feared he didn't speak.
Oh, okay.
No, like his part, I don't know. He just grins and looks kind of creepy.
Yeah. And he likes music boxes.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know how to feel about that. I mean, I guess if you have a part and you have to fill it and that's all right. So you put Ben Foster in it.
All right.
I've just seen him in so many things where he really carried his weight.
He's a good actor.
And it just seemed, I mean, he's not as throwaway in this as, say, like X-Men 3, where his job was literally like to fly around in a
scene.
So
that there'd be somebody in the air when they did expansive
right,
shots.
Right, exactly. We have a wide shot. We need someone in the air.
Yeah.
That was literally the extent of his purpose there. He's coming up in Hostage, which we'll do in a billion weeks or something.
Yeah, sure.
But he's good in that. And he did some 6 Feet Under stuff. That was where I first saw him. That was good. He pops up just in these weird places.
Well, we should probably get into the actual film because the cast is probably the least important part of this film.
So the first thing that grabs me from this, and this is like, I'm going to rag on this film a little bit
here. I expect you to.
It's an odd kind of, it's intriguing.
Yeah.
It's a curious kind of film. Yeah. It had these qualities that reminded me over and over of Big Fish.
Mm.
Just these strange kind of storytelling, like sort of surreal moments.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of that comes from the fact that like Big Fish, it's got, Big Fish has two storylines going simultaneously,
right,
where this has three.
Yeah.
And they're all coinciding, but like in a way that they're completely independent of each other.
Sure.
Like you could like, so we're doing Dr. Horrible also in this show, and that's divided into three acts.
Yeah, sure.
North Fork could very easily be three short films that are all from the same universe.
That kind of brings me into another point I had, which is that the transitions in this from kind of the different stories, there's a couple of different ways to do your transitions. And this one, you know, there was no gimmick to it, which I kind of like. I mean, different sort of transitions work in different films for different reasons. But this one opted to just go with trust that your audience can figure it out for themselves.
Well, I think that there was heavy reliance on the fact that there were certain characters per certain stories.
Sure.
Like Nick Nolte only shows up in one story. He has a crossover point into the James Woods like story at one part where he's like, your wife. But James Woods, they all kind of cross over with certain characters. But there are like, for example, the character Cup of Tea, who I love, only shows up in the one storyline.
Right. And that's one of the ways to tell. And I think a lot of times you have kind of, you know, we always go back to Lost for transitions because that's just something that sticks out in my head. You have the whoosh sound and that's how you know it's a flashback, which is a little unnecessary. And I'm, you know, I'm not going to get into that with Lost, but a lot of films will do this, where they don't need a kind of gimmick to tell you like we're moving into the past.
Mm-hmm.
It always kind of reminds me of the cheesy like kind of 80s dream sequence.
Where they cloud the edges of the frame.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Or you get like the kind of waves and the harp.
Yeah.
It's not necessary.
Where like, Sabrina looks up in the air and then it pans up to where her eyes are looking and then everything's wavy and people talk exaggerated.
We can figure it out. We get it as an audience. You don't have to, you know, speak down to us. And I really like that about this, that the transitions also kind of make the film a little, I don't want to say harder to figure out, but a little more ambiguous in what it's doing, what it's trying to accomplish.
It's a really enigmatic film.
Right. And part of it is that.
Yeah.
If they cut out, you know, if they did it, like you said, in short stories or just spliced it into acts, then, you know, part of that enigma would be gone because it's so spelled out. By kind of just letting you flow from sort of one world to the next, it gives it a much more surreal atmosphere without relying on a gimmick. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of hard to do when you're trying to... That was a lot of what this movie did right for me, was the sort of surreal atmosphere.
Yeah.
And a lot of times that just has to rely on a gimmick. Mm-hmm. But in this case, it, for the most part, it didn't.
I think that the like shaky ground that the film treads when it gets into the surrealism is that it doesn't do anything to like set it apart from the reality.
Right.
I mean, even in like films recently, I've been seeing a lot of like the surreal stuff has more color. Or there's like more vibrant.
They do something visually to it.
And in this film, like some, there's just like these guys that drive Fords who are actually like, in my opinion, more surreal than like the dream people.
Yeah, absolutely.
But then there's like the people in the dream who like have removable hands.
Right.
Are both men, male and female. And
there's the monster. Can we talk about that?
Let's get into the monster.
Looks like something out of, I think I mentioned this on the last show, but No, I've never thankfully seen The Dark Crystal.
I'm gonna buy
on that is that on the, are you just going to start buying films I don't want to see?
Yeah.
Reminds me, you still haven't played The Darkness, but something out of like Otherworld in The Darkness where it's all like fucked up and in hell and there's like creatures made of different parts and with beaks and stuff. It reminds me a lot of that. It's like, it's on like really long legs and it's got some kind of like strange beak deer face. You're just like, what is it? And then it gets shot by a tranquilizer dart. Yep,
and it's down.
That's it.
I think that my favorite part about the incorporation of the monster is the fact that it's really tall. And the whole time you see it, you subconsciously just want to see it fall down.
Yeah.
And then they knock it down.
Yeah,
absolutely. They're like, we don't need this anymore. But people wanted to see it fall down.
Yeah. Parts of that reminded me of The Cell a little bit.
Yeah.
You got these really strange, just like monster kind of like, creature things.
Kind of like Salvador Dali-esque.
Like, this whole time, I didn't want to get too ridiculous.
Yeah.
But yeah, it kind of borders on Salvador Dali a bit. Yeah, it's interesting that you point out that there isn't kind of a visual gimmick either with this, which is hard because it's sort of a period piece.
Yeah.
So you have to use the period piece visual style.
Yeah.
Which is one of the first things you note about a film like this. It's desaturated, but almost to a point where it's black and white.
Yeah.
I mean, there are scenes in that where there's literally almost no color.
Yeah. Most of the scenes with James Woods and the whole like evac team are all entirely black and white, even though the scenes are shot in color. They're just like in a deserty like area and all the cars are black and they're wearing suits.
Yeah, part of that is literally the desaturation in the film, like in post-production or in what you're shooting on. But another part of it is just color tones of what's there. You know, it's dirt, it's barren, it's like, it's desert. It's kind of a wasteland. And even the houses they're in are kind of run down, which just, I mean, in a film that sort of tries to play on the fantasy, it's a bit of a downer for me. Every time they go back out there and everybody's starving and nobody has any money. Yeah. And I'm like, oh.
And then the color comes from the Chevys.
It reminds me a bit of maybe Pan's Labyrinth in a way, that kind of like escapism because you're in this sort of place that is so fucking awful, but it managed to kind of deal with a couple different stories while doing that. And I like that about it.
I'm going to interrupt you briefly and just say that one of my favorite things about this film is that the scenes, like, whereas we had this conversation recently, how I would never like be comfortable removing a scene from a film just to watch the short scene.
Right.
But the film has a few really nice, like really interesting and for whatever reason, like humorous, like little vignettes.
Yeah.
That go on. And I think that the reason that that works is because it's set back in the 50s vignettes, like when it's just like the 50s guys, like the evac team.
Yeah.
They are really funny.
They're weird.
Yeah.
That's what it is. It's almost an awkward laughter that it forces out of you. One of the scenes I think that was just so well played is when they're actually going into people's houses and trying to talk to them. So you have, that's one third of the movie's kind of overall story. One of the different story, one of the kind of different story arcs that the movie has, but then there's three different ones within that. And I like the way they handled the unveiling of the wings and the rifle at the same time to kind of parallel that.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you're dealing, you know, you always have to kind of ask when a movie does something a little strange like that, is it doing it for the sake of being odd or is there kind of a point to that? I mean, period films in general are great because, you know, we've asked that question before on this show is when you have a period film, why is it a period film? Is it just because you want to do that?
Doing that's a just period a world piece is just always just dangerous if it's just like something you want to do. But if a film can't be taken outside of the period, then you need to do it that way.
Yeah, if the story requires that. Mm-hmm. And I felt like the thing with the rifle and the wings, I mean, having those two parallel stories kind of coincide there was a reason right there just to have those kind of non-overlapping stories that had a sort of an accidental collision there.
I think that the reason that that particular scene, and I'm glad you pointed it out because I really like that part of the film. I think that the reason that that parallel is a really good paradox to the rest of the film is that there's these guys going in trying to get people to leave. And then there's this kid who's like this innocent kid and he's trying to like prove to them that he was an angel. And these guys go in and you're like, oh, they're going to, you know, do something. And they open this thing up and you're like, well, the first thing that comes to my mind is like, they're going to like what they would do in like a dire situation is like pull out a gun, be like, you have to leave.
Right. Yeah.
And instead the little kid pulls out a gun. And he's like, this is what they shot me with. And they're like, hey, these are some wings.
Well, and those two stories too. I mean, here's one of the stories is about this kid trying to get out.
Yeah.
And he can't.
Yeah.
And then the obvious other parallel to that is this team going in and trying to get these people who don't want to leave out.
Yeah.
The overall problem that I have with the film is that it borders on absurdity so much that I have trouble kind of going along with the ride.
Mm-hmm.
I have trouble sort of buying into different concepts it has. You know, I could go on all day about little things, which I'll just overlook. But the thing that really sort of got me is, you know, you have a film that does these kind of obscure things. And every once in a while, you know, you've put yourself in a point where it's kind of fantasy and it's a little weird. And you're mm-hmm. just like we were talking about the awkward laughter.
Mm-hmm.
And you go along with that. But then it'll try and deal something a little heavy handed to you. And you don't know if you can take
mostly
that.
Mostly Nick Nolte.
Yeah. Which, you know, I bought his stuff.
Yeah.
But you have that James Woods scene. With the car, right? With the ding in the car.
Yeah.
Which they kind of, you know, they kind of, I don't want to say foreshadow, but they kind of hit on it a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
And, you know, the same movie that's trying to get me to buy the Nick in the car is a metaphor,
mm-hmm.
which, I mean, on paper, that's great.
Sure.
I had a new car a couple of years ago and that fucking first scratch is the worst thing in the universe.
Yeah.
And that's a perfect metaphor for life and blah, blah, blah. Okay, we get it. But this is the same movie that literally handed me have your cake and eat it too with a literal cake.
Yeah.
In the beginning of the film.
Well, I think,
like,
I think
I have trouble just, I don't know what this movie wants from me.
Yeah, we were talking about how the film does a lot of things where, and I think that this is a strength of the film. I don't want to like make it out that I think that it's a poor delivery, but the film does a lot of things where it takes like cliches and like obvious like what are you talking about, Willis?
Yeah, right.
and the delivery of like that, or like Sarah mentioned Duck Duck Goose.
Right, yeah.
And stuff like that. Like the cast acts, like the actors while they're in the
role. It's deadpan, right?
They seem so oblivious to the fact that they're like.
No one cracks a smile at any of the jokes.
It's like they're not even like, it's like the film doesn't realize that it's making a joke. It's like the film was shot in the 50s and then the jokes came from it.
Became relevant later on.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
It'd be like,
I kind of like that on paper, but in execution, it just makes me feel awkward.
I thought it was really well done in the film. Yeah. Especially, I give the film a lot of credit for being able to pull off, what are you talking about, Willis?
Yeah, I didn't believe that was happening.
Yeah.
I thought it was an accident as it came in. Well, and there's stuff that sort of the kind of angel characters from that story, from one of the more surreal stories, I guess. And pretty much any of the jokes they make are so, they're handed to you in such a heavy way.
Yeah.
If you can't accept a little light deadpan humor earlier on, like, this is some of the driest humor ever.
Yep.
And it relies on a lot of the puns of their names, especially Happy.
Happy.
I don't know. And some of that stuff I just don't buy. I mean, part of it, you know, there's an excuse for it, right? I mean, it's kind of in the kid's head. It's sort of fantasy land.
Yeah.
And that's sort of where you want that stuff to be. But in execution, I just found myself rolling my eyes so hard at it. It was like sort of embarrassing to watch.
I really like the film. I mean, I know what you're saying and I can totally understand where you're coming from. I think that the reason that I'm okay with the film doing that is because it seems like the film was dealt with, not like the writing, but the direction, especially the art direction and the photo direction.
Mm.
Wow, I'm getting technical.
Yeah.
This is like a first.
Do you want to switch chairs or are you okay over there?
No, my chair's lower. It works better for me.
Okay, all right.
The art direction and the like photography of the film is dealt with in such like a heavy way. It's really clear that they put a lot of thought into every shot.
Right.
And even more so like into the division of shots per scene.
Mm-hmm.
By that, I mean, specifically like when they're in the boat talking to the guy with the two wives.
Right.
And they tell him that story. And then part of the story cuts to the story happening.
Right,
and James Woods is like, you know, mounted on the boat telling the story
again,
while they're
in a no transition kind of way. You don't need a transition. We know that this is a story. This didn't just literally happen now.
The dedication to like really planning out shots and scenes really makes me like okay with the fact that there's like little weird writing, like quirks in the writing, because it, I know that they mean it in like a really, like they mean it the way that it comes out. It's right. Not like an accident. We were talking about a couple days ago about how you're not sure if Kid Rock is serious or
right, if it's an elaborate ruse. Yeah. Well, I compared it to MSI, or Marilyn Manson does that a bit too. Yeah, I still can't tell if Kid Rock's kind of just playing a stereotypical Southern
and
redneck.
For example, like if you were to find out that Kid Rock was faking his entire career, would you be more into Kid Rock?
I would be so much more.
Okay,
into Kid
Rock. Like the fact that like I know that this whole film, like when they do something like quirky and seemingly satirical, I know that that's what they want it to be, because they deal with the film in such like a heavy-handed, like overbearing directional sense. That I know that what comes from the film is intentional. At least I feel that way after seeing like the elaborate like definition that goes into each of the scenes.
When we started watching this movie, I kind of wondered like, man, this is an odd thing to see in Michael's library. and no, it hits all the staples.
Yeah, you got the blood, people die.
And ass shot.
You get the ass shot.
Of course.
And then the thing at the end with the house, which actually made you jump.
Yeah.
This film comes complete with a scare shot.
Ridiculous.
Possibly one of the like most like
absurd is what I'm saying about this film.
They just do a shot of the house that everybody's been in the whole time, and then the plane flies over it and like a loud like fucking engines roaring over a completely silent frame, and you fell off the couch.
We had a writer's strike, and Joss Whedon put out this thing. Because during the strike, you can't do anything creative, right? Because you're not supposed to write. It's
except,
pencils down.
Except write the sequel to Forrest Gump.
Yeah, that's why all this X-Files stuff came out. And all right, so Whedon's the guy who did, we talked about this before, but he did Buffy, he did Angel, I think. He did Serenity and Firefly, which is the stuff I actually know.
And
I don't, I'm
matter.
Not going to pretend I know Buffy because I don't
even want
actually.
To.
Actually, okay. So he gets basically some friends of his, people he's worked with together, and he decides, you know what? Here's the problem. We have production in the way. So I'm just going to make my own shit and I'm going to put it out on the internet. So I found this. I found this recently. I was like way late to the game because he's got this thing, Dollhouse, that he's doing now or something. And I wasn't paying attention to it. And so I found this and I've been showing it to literally everyone I know. Everybody's seen this multiple times now.
Uh-huh.
Usually this question is not actually raised on the show.
Yeah.
Because no one cares. But oh, great Michael Kester. How do you feel about Dr. Horrible's singing blog?
I don't want to talk about it.
Oh, no, seriously, give this to me. Give this to me.
All right. So in principle, it's really impressive as like a get around it, independent, fund yourself around the writer's strike thing. And I think that of the thing, like had they just done Act One, I would like rave about it.
You like Act One better.
I loved Act One, easily the best.
Wow.
Because Acts 2 and 3 seemed like Ben Stiller, Judd Apatow stuff.
You think so?
Yeah.
See, Act One for me is all setup. It's none of the delivery.
Yeah, but I thought all the delivery was like lame and like Ben Stiller. And so, it really, really got to me. Like I wanted,
you're referencing specifically Neil Patrick Harris.
No, that toward the end, there was a lot like in the, so here's, I'll break it down.
Sure.
Act One, Neil Patrick Harris was getting on my nerves. I like him, but I think just
I don't
like,
know him. What is he?
He's
he
not
a,
done
some
much.
TV
he's
show
in,
or yeah, something.
See,
now.
That's the thing is he's like he acts like he's in a TV show in this.
Right.
In this.
It's
like
a blog,
lot,
man. I'm all right.
Still,
with that.
He acts
all
like right. He's in a TV show, and a lot of his delivery is like sitcom, which I think was what was bothering me.
Right.
But then, fucking Nathan Fillion shows up, and he's like incredible. Singing in like a ridiculously weird voice and riding a van. And
I have this theory that Nathan Fillion can't sing. Would
yeah.
you pick up on that?
Oh yeah.
Because second act rolls around and he doesn't even have anything.
Yeah.
He just gives funny looks
yeah.
While
yeah.
at the ducks
and then,
in the
and
park.
Then,
while,
and then does the penis line.
Right. Which I think is one of the most triumphant parts.
The penis,
of the
collection penis line,
of jokes.
Although it was incredibly Judd Apatow. Like by Judd Apatow, I'm going to speak specifically to Superbad because that's the only Judd Apatow I could see.
All right.
Like most of the rest was like Ben Stiller, like Dodgeball. But, the penis line was really like it caught me as really super bad, which I fucking hate. However, I like that line and it was funny. And I think it was because Nathan Fillion delivered it.
part of it is sort of the anticipation.
I wasn't anticipating it.
They throw the camera on him in this angle where there's tons of blank space to the left.
Well, it's because he walked off the frame.
And they hold it. You're just like, something's going to happen.
I thought he was going to say something.
Oh, jerk.
Yeah.
Like, balls. And that would be.
Yeah.
See, so you balls, like act one.
Balls was the beginning of the end for me.
Really?
Yeah.
You didn't dig balls?
Balls and then downhill.
Because I feel like.
Balls roll downhill.
I want to get to the music thing, but I don't want to do that first because I want to stick on these characters for a little bit. It's pretty much led by three characters.
Yeah.
I mean, we have a lot of bit parts here and there that are mostly like cameos for longtime fans of Whedon's other
Captain
stuff.
Captain Liberty?
Or yeah, the Captain Liberty thing. I was going to see how long I could go in this without referencing The Tick.
The Tick.
But so you would not mark this up as the successor to The Tick?
No.
See, because that's why this excites me. So The Tick is a lot of things, right? It's a comic and a game and a fucking Fox News. Wow.
Yeah.
Fox News. Saturday morning, whatever cartoon when we were like kids. But the Tick's shining moment was when it was
Patrick Warburton.
When it was a live action sitcom
for 9 episodes,
which it's 9 episodes and it makes me sad because it's some of the funniest shit ever
written on television.
It's adults who have all gone on to kind of do other stuff. In superhero uniforms.
Yeah. It's easily my favorite TV show.
Yeah,
like comedy.
I really dig it. And, you know, Batman Well went on to do The Dark Knight.
And everything else.
And Kane or whatever for a while and Lost.
And Lost, yep.
And apparently Captain Liberty also makes a sort of cameo at the end. So you
also, I think we mentioned The Tick earlier when we talk about Ron Perlman and the doubling of superhero roles.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
He plays Fiery Blaze.
When Joss put this thing together, do you think he kind of had The Tick in mind?
No.
I mean, when you have a cameo like that at the end, I mean, that's a cameo, right?
Well, kind of, yeah, but I don't know. I don't think he had it in mind. I think that might have been like a reference.
Right.
But I mean, I really don't see parallels other than superheroes and like the fact that they're like funny and human beings.
So we touched on
bad superheroes.
Right. We touched on the Nathan Fillion thing, which, you know, I think for what he does in this, see, that's where it really reminds me of The Tick, because you have like the meat-headed fucking like superhero.
Yeah,
the
but see, there are like, no characters like that in The Tick.
Well, that's kind of The Tick.
No, he's not.
I mean,
he's
oblivious.
Like, yeah, oblivious is different than being like self-centered and like...
Well, so the characters have different nuances, but we're still dealing with the, you know, basic simpleton archetype.
Yeah.
You know,
I have a problem. The reason I have a problem with this is people act like it's a sitcom and I'm not sure if it's supposed to be that way.
Well, we're looking at it as kind of a film.
I know. And that's why I have to take it to task for having sitcom actors.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm going to ask you to look at this as if it were on TV, even though it's not.
Yeah.
That's hard for me to do because I obviously wanted to incorporate it in the show. Because if you couldn't tell by now, I'm fucking in love with this thing. It's one of the greatest things I've seen all year. And, you know, I wanted to talk about it on the show. It's 3 parts. It's 45 minutes. They're thinking about doing a 4th part, but it's pretty much finished.
Yeah.
It's one little capsulated body of work. But you're looking at his stuff. I mean, the caliber of his stuff is TV stuff. He's a TV guy. Like, Whedon does stuff for TV.
Mm-hmm.
There's the exception of Serenity, but I mean, that was because
based on TV.
Yeah, that's because of the fallout of Firefly. Did you catch the signatures joke, by the way?
No.
So... she, in the first act, she's got the petition and she's trying to get him to sign. And he just like, he does like this look at her and he's just like, signatures. And I love that. That was such a Firefly thing. Cause that whole show was, that was like the first big online signatures are going to change everything.
Oh.
And everyone was like, we'll just all sign this online petition. And then the show has to stay on, which clearly happened. So, I mean, I expected TV caliber out of it because although that's not really the medium is iTunes. You know, if you're going to get this thing, I mean, it's come out on DVD or it's, I don't know what the DVD deal is, but they basically like they didn't pay anybody for it and they put it out on iTunes hoping to like recover the costs. But for something that's independent, I feel like it surpasses standard TV quality even.
I would say so. I would say that if this were on television, it would be entertaining. Right. I probably wouldn't watch it.
It's only 45 minutes. The fact that there's three episodes.
I mean, like if it were a continued series.
Oh, right.
And they're like doing episodes weekly, whatever.
Well, come on though. It's a musical. I mean, weekly TV isn't actually a viable.
Well, even if like hypothetically, I would not watch
it. Yeah, but it's not a weekly TV show and it's not a film. I mean, I get what you're saying. It feels a little like a sitcom, but it's this bizarre new medium. And
yeah,
I want to look at this outside of a comedy though, because even if none of the jokes work for you, I really do think there's so much more there. I mean, even if you took every joke out of this thing, I would love it. I would still love it.
I would
just
like
as
it
much.
More.
Well, I mean, so often when we look at comedies, all we ever ask ourselves is, does it make us laugh? Yes or no?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the basis on which we decide whether or not it's a good film. Unfortunately, when something is labeled as a comedy, we tend to overlook all of the other things it does that make it absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, we don't do that with any other genre. When something is a drama, we don't ask ourselves, well, how dramatic was it? And that determines how good it is. But we really do that with comedy. And I think if we fall into too much of that here, we're going to really miss out. So before I give you another chance to yet again invoke Judd Apatow here, I want to talk about all the subtleties that make this thing really genius. And before we even get into that, so the thing with the characters that I absolutely love, that'll feed into a lot of these subtleties later,
mm-hmm.
is this strange separation you have in the different sides of, well, Dr. Horrible, for instance, is a great example of this. And something that really makes me like films like Hellboy a lot.
Yeah.
You have a big, strong hero who is almost a hero because he needs that to cover his own insecurities. You know, Dr. Horrible can pull off these great heists. He can build these weapons of destruction, but he can't, you know, talk to a girl at a laundromat.
Uh-huh.
And it's almost like maybe in any other situation, I would say he's using the guise of Dr. Horrible to basically cover, you know, his insecurities, cover the fact that he's a little bit neurotic. But here, and I'll talk about this again with the ending, I think that's almost the opposite. Maybe at one point, Billy was truly who he was, but I think he's become so involved with Dr. Horrible. And that's part of what this whole story is the transition to see which one of him is really him and which is the disguise.
Yeah.
And he talks a lot about social change. I think Brand New Day is really, really exemplary of this. You get it in the intro and even the rest of the song. It reinforces this lack of typical exposition that we get over and over in these superhero films and just in films in general.
Mm-hmm.
So many times we have to be explained point by point what the plot is, what the villain wants to do. You
right.
know, it's kind of that Bond villain syndrome.
Yeah.
I mean, here we have our roadmap. You know, we know where we're beginning. We know where we want to end, and we kind of know what the plan is for what's going to happen in the middle. And we don't really need the technical details of the plan. We don't want to get too bogged down with that. Because in the hour or so that, you know, in the 45 minutes that we have to spend with these characters, we want to get to know the characters.
Mm-hmm.
We want to get to know them emotionally. We want to know what their motivations are. And we can't do that if we have to spend too much time on the plot.
Yeah.
In the song Brand New Day, when he talks about being vague on the how, I really think that's kind of pointing out that, yeah, we're not too concerned with exactly how this plan's going to work. We kind of know the gist of it. But it's far more, even in the song, than talking about the plan. He's talking about what he's going through. And in talking about Brand New Day, I mean, the music in this is fucking awesome. None of the songs go on too long, which is the fault, I think, of a lot of musicals. You know, you have songs that are like 5, 6, 7 minutes. In this, all of the numbers are pretty much under a minute or two, with a few exceptions. And I think that's fantastic. You also get a lot of really haunting instrumentation, even in places you don't expect it. You know, you think back now on the song Man's Gotta Do, you think of it as kind of this cheesy Captain Hammer thing, but you forget that in the very beginning, you get this little haunting instrumentation. And that comes up a lot when we're just dealing with Dr. Horrible. And I think a lot of that music is what helps us feel like he's the villain, even though for, you know, in the viewer's eyes, he's the protagonist. In the storyline, he's really the antagonist here. And the music is part of what helps you remember that.
The music itself was really good. And a lot of the like songs were really good. But a lot of the songs, like, they collapse the rhymes to come up with shitty jokes.
You think so?
Yeah.
A lot of this music, it doesn't have, you know, your typical score feel or your typical music feel. It really has a lot of character to it. And I think that's a lot of what I like about this thing is just the overwhelming amounts of character that are poured into it. Another thing that really gives it a lot of character, and you see this a lot in the second act, is kind of the cheap effects that they use. I mean, given that this thing is independent, you know, it makes it feel almost like a film your friends made. And these are effects that work, and I think they work so well because we haven't seen them a million times before. You know, in the first act, we have the thing in my freeze ray, which, you know, they kind of take a still image of one of the shots. Yeah. They essentially pause the film, mm-hmm. Except for Neil Patrick Harris, who's still singing. And, you know, it's a simple effect, but I think it really works. And again, it's not something we see all the time. In the second act, you get a couple effects that are, you know, they're kind of things that are sped up or different tricks with size. And there's stuff that you have to laugh at, and you really are laughing with the film. I mean, it gives it a lot of its charm. They open the third act with So They Say, which is a really good opening. It really moves the pace along. It makes you feel like you're finally building up to what's coming. And it's funny, too. I mean, it's something that's a little more uplifting, and you have to do that with the pieces that aren't directly, you know, sung by or about Dr. Horrible, because his stuff tends to be a little more haunting, a little more aggressive. And this kind of picks you back up and reminds you that the world outside of this Dr. Horrible character is still a good, decent world. What I really think shines about this third act, though, is the last few numbers, particularly Slipping. Again, this is something where you have a really, really chilling song. And before, where you only kind of got notes of it, I mean, this is full on. The whole song is just, it gives you chills. We finally see the empowerment of Dr. Horrible. Things are finally really going right for him. You know, people are running in terror, and he seems to have, you know, the upper hand on the hero.
Uh-huh.
And you get, you know, the evil cackle. I mean, this is finally the Dr. Horrible he sees himself as.
Yeah.
The number speaks for itself, so I'm not going to talk about it too much. But when Captain Hammer comes back at the end, that's a great bit too, when he's singing, you know, the last line of the previous song. I think that's fantastic. So then Dr. Horrible leads to the...
Indirectly.
Inadvertently leads to the death of Penny, this girl he's trying to win over.
Yeah.
And she delivers this line that I think is just fantastic, and the thing I keep coming back to when I think about how emotionally charged and what an incredible ending that this film has, without really being too overbearing or too force-fed. He goes over to her, and she's on her deathbed, and she says to him, "Don't worry, Captain Hammer will save us." Wow, fucking heart-wrenching. You know, for starters, she's looking at him and, you know, he thought maybe they had chemistry. And we even see earlier in the film in the second act where maybe she almost kisses him, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe there's something going on here. And now on her deathbed, you know, moment of truth, he's not the one she's thinking about. She's effectively saying, you can't save us. This isn't something you can do. Almost like scoffing at the idea. You know, it's not even in consideration. He's run over to her and she's not saying, hey, help me. She's saying, Captain Hammer.
Right.
So then you have the second layer where it's not just anybody she wants help from. It's his rival. I mean, it almost looked like he's won. You know, Captain Hammer has run off with a boo-boo and, you know, Dr. Horrible has won this round. But he goes over to Penny and she's saying, Captain Hammer will save us. And it's like, even though physically he's won this battle, you know, he's still got her heart, even after the awful things, you know, he said about her.
Mm-hmm.
So you have that layer of it. And then you have the fact that he's the villain. I mean, which is probably the most devastating of all these things. She wants the good guy, you know, he's hearing this and he's going, yeah, I am evil. You know, everything he was ashamed to show her, he was rightfully ashamed of because she doesn't want any part of it. You know, at the end of the day, Dr. Horrible has terrorized her and she wants Captain Hammer, the good guy, to come and save her, almost suggesting that maybe they were completely incompatible from the start, which on top of killing her was really the most horrible thing she could hear from him.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I just think in that one line, just in that delivery, there's just so much that it's saying in, you know, something that I've now ranted on for like 5 minutes in just a few simple words. I think that's incredible. So that's really our bittersweet ending. And then we get to Everything You Ever, which is, you know, the longest song in the film and probably my favorite. We spend the first couple minutes of it, you know, really going through the stages of grief after Penny's death and seeing that just get to him and have that effect on him. But it's bittersweet in that although he accidentally caused her death instead of Captain Hammer's, that death is what gets him into the evil league of evil, right, which is the other thing he wanted this entire time. And so now we see this full transformation, you know, where he's walking through the party and, you know, the final bit of him suiting up. Now the nightmare's real, that whole section of the song where he is Dr. Horrible full time now, you know, we see the full transition of his character. And here's another thing I really love just in this number. Another thing that kind of explores something Whedon's really, really good at is creating a universe with so many characters that you don't even get to see, really. You know, he takes this idea that every character is a protagonist in their own world. You know, we all think we're the hero of our story. And you look at Dr. Horrible's world and all of these background characters, even the characters who know their place, like Moist, they have backstories to them. They have things that are going on. You know, just to look through the credits of this, and really this is one of those things where you gotta watch the credits. You know, you have the Purple Pimp in the scene, you have the Bad Horse chorus coming back. I really like that bit with the Bad Horse ringtone on the second act. Fake Thomas Jefferson, Dead Bowie. I mean, there's just so every single one of these characters that he's kind of walking through and talking to or runs into at the end could have their own entire comic just based on them. And I think that's this level of devotion that I wish I would see in so many more things where you just, this guy, I mean, Whedon's overflowing with ideas. He has so many, they will not even fit into this film. And I think that's fantastic. And then, of course, the great reveal too, at the same time when you're getting, you know, Dead Bowie and everything at the end, that Bad Horse is literally played by a horse, which I don't know. It's just one of those jokes that so works for me. Somehow I just didn't see that coming at all. And it's just awesome. So although we get this tragic ending, he almost got what he wanted. And because of the way that events unfolded, the evil side of him has really taken over. You know, these kind of two sides that are always at war, even though he doesn't really realize that, you know, he's got this like softer side of him, this more emotionally fragile side. And then he's got, you know, the badass evil side, and the evil's just taken over. Until we see the very last scene of this thing, which is the I won't feel a thing scene. And on the words a thing, we see the scene of him in front of the webcam in his just normal everyday laundromat attire, not in the Dr. Horrible getup. Almost this suggestion that maybe he's continuing the double life, but the kind of background role now is of Billy, the civilian, and maybe there's still hope for him yet. Anyways, I'm done trying to convince you. What are we doing next week?
Next week, we're going back to The Prophecy 2 and Terminator 2, but in the opposite order.
If people can handle that.
Yeah.
I was with some people the other day who rolled their eyes at the fact that I was about to watch The Prophecy 2. How do you feel about...
Who has seen The Prophecy 2?
Some people I met at a diner.
They've probably never seen it.
No, they totally seen it. And they're like, Prophecy 2, blah, blah, not as good as Prophecy 1.
It's not.
Oh. So if you want to give Michael really awful criticism about his hatred of Dr. Horrible, mm-hmm. you can log on to our website at doublefutureshow.com. I love when the hate mail pours in. So just please send us... Actually, send us really nice things.
They can send me hate mail. I'm
well,
sure
send Michael hate mail. I probably get it all the time. All right. Yeah, I just get... It's not like they have anything
to dislike you for. Like, you're like, no, that was okay. No, I felt that. That was good, I guess. And I'm like, no, that was bad.
Well,
we'll see when the next
Prophecy movie comes up, how that works. We have a MySpace and a Facebook, too. People should go on these. And I still urge you to subscribe in iTunes. Is there anything else?
Can you explain what a podcast is to me?
No.
Watch more fucking film.
Bye. You're so wrong about that.
No, sorry, dude.